Hello, listeners. If you've been tuning in recently, you may already know we're working our way through a series of episodes on improving accessibility for people with disabilities in healthcare. In our first episode, we talked about the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Disabilities in Nutrition and Dietetics Member Interest Group. Now, that's a long name. And it has just enough gravitas to hint at how instrumental this newly formed group actually is. We spent most of episode one discussing how the member interest group was established and what it strives to accomplish as it grows and continues to gain traction. Our second episode discussed building a better culture of accessibility for professionals with disabilities in the healthcare sector. And in our most recent episode, we shifted gears slightly to talk about how best to advocate for and improve accessibility for outpatients, especially as it relates to nutrition intervention. So that leads us to today. It's the fourth of five episodes, and here we'll delve into accessibility in the inpatient setting. I'm Mara Bowen with Abbott Nutrition Health Institute's Power of Nutrition podcast. Dr. Susie Baxter and Elena Morales, both registered dietitians, are back with me to serve as our experts. I'm in the studio, and Susie and Elena are dialing in, so you may notice some differences in how we sound across this recording. So, with that said, Susie, Elena, thanks for joining me again today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you. So excited to be back.
Great. So, as we usually do, let's start with introductions. Susie, would you mind telling us a little bit about your background?
Well, certainly. Well, if you've been able to listen to any of the first three podcasts in the series, you'll recall that I completed my dietetics education in the coordinated undergraduate program in dietetics at Texas Christian University, my master's and doctoral degrees at Texas Woman's University, and then a postdoctoral fellowship at the Medical College of Georgia. I began my career in 1981 as the only dietitian in a residential school for children with disabilities. Next, I was an outpatient dietitian for diverse low-income adults. And then I was a training and quality control food service supervisor in a school district. After that, I was the WIC supervisor in a public health department. But for most of my career, I've conducted nutrition research as a faculty member at the Medical College of Georgia and then at the University of South Carolina. In 2010, I was diagnosed with an acquired disability named erythromelalgia. That's a rare neurovascular pain disorder. It most commonly affects the feet, but also hands, face, and other body parts. Now, there's no cure for it, and medication is pretty much hit and miss and doesn't work for me. So I've had to make major lifestyle changes to help decrease the frequency and severity of the pain episodes. I did work for 7 years after my diagnosis, but simply was unable to keep up, and I had to resign my research professor position at the end of 2016.
Thank you for sharing, Susie. And Elena, how about you?
Of course. Yeah, if you're not familiar with my story, I acquired disabling chronic illnesses from a young age and was later hit by a car. As a child, I came across the disability rights movement and its roots within Berkeley, and that inspired me to go to Berkeley for college to study dietetics and disability studies. Over the years, I've participated in the disability community through many hats. At Berkeley, I worked for disability access and compliance to help optimize physical, technological, and programmatic access for people with disabilities. And I've also engaged in various disability activism by creating new organizations, developing wellness programs for students with disabilities, and creating one of the first disability cultural centers in the country. Later, I joined a three-year research project at the University of California, San Francisco, where we analyzed the impact of SNAP for SSI recipients. In 2021, I continued my education at Berkeley by attending their Individualized Supervised Practice Pathway, or ISPP for short. So I received my RD in 2022 and now primarily work as a clinical dietitian in San Diego in the inpatient setting.
Great. Well, thank you both for sharing your background. In our last episode, we talked a bit about the prevalence of disabilities in our country here in the United States. And we were focusing at that moment on helping people with disabilities get the care they need as outpatients. But today, I'm going to ask comparable questions through the lens of the inpatient setting. So starting with an easy one, in what ways might having a disability impact nutrition status for inpatients?
Sure, that's a great question. So as we've discussed, disability can impact nutrition status in many ways. In the inpatient setting specifically, there are several things to consider. In 2019, 84% of adult inpatient stays were for patients with one or more comorbidities. Many of these patients may identify as disabled or may require additional accommodations depending on their individual situation. Recall how we've discussed many interactions between disability and nutrition status in the outpatient setting. Examples of this would be things like higher rates of food inaccessibility, impacted ability to buy groceries or cook, disproportionate wealth and food security amongst the disability community, and much more. This can thus increase a patient's nutrition risk and be the reason a patient is admitted to the hospital, or it can exacerbate the primary reason for admission, of course. Now, there isn't a lot of literature that expands upon the relationship between disability-related malnutrition and inpatient hospital stays, but we do know that the average length of stay for disabled patients specifically is 9.5 days, while the average length of stay for the entire population is only 5.5 days. Now, regardless of disability, 20 to 50% of patients who are admitted to the hospital present with malnutrition. The highest risk factors for this have been age, comorbidities, and polypharmacy. And as we know, these are all factors which intimately relate with disability. As dietitians, we all know that presenting with malnutrition upon admission increases length of stay and can also lead to higher rates of morbidity and mortality, and can also be very costly to the hospital as well. So if the disability community is already set up for failure, quote unquote, in this community by systems that increase the disproportionate cost and effort of obtaining adequate nutrition, and we know that malnutrition leads to these negative outcomes in the inpatient setting, then we can infer that people with disabilities will have poor outcomes of recovery. But again, additional data is vitally needed to hold inpatient facilities accountable to create solutions that will improve outcomes for people with disabilities. So overall, this just summarizes the nutrition-related injustice that already exists once a patient with a disability just enters the hospital. So now let's consider how disability may impact one's nutrition status during the inpatient stay. Regardless of disability, 49% of malnourished patients hospitalized for more than a week face a further deterioration of their nutrition status. And 30% of previously well-nourished patients actually developed malnutrition during their hospital stay. So think about how these numbers can adversely affect the disability community. As a hospital environment, it doesn't offer the same types of accommodations that people with disabilities are used to at home when it comes to feeding, taking care of themselves, or the hospital environment may actually cause a disabled patient with dementia, for example, or other illness, distress, and subsequently discourage them to eat.
Oh, Elena, wow. The information you just shared is so important, but it's basically been overlooked to date. I'd like to share briefly now about a report titled The Impact of COVID-19 on People with Disabilities. This was the National Council on Disabilities Progress Report for 2021. The Council monitored pandemic-related developments, examined emerging research, and relied on stakeholder involvement to develop this report. Now, people with intellectual or developmental disabilities and medically fragile and technology-dependent individuals faced a high risk of being triaged out of COVID-19 treatment when hospital beds, supplies, and personnel were scarce. They were denied the use of their personal ventilator devices after admission to hospital, and at times were even denied the assistance of critical support persons during hospital stays. People with certain disabilities were targeted for denial of care by informal and formal crisis standards of care pronouncements that guided the provision of scarce healthcare resources in surge situations. When the vaccines received emergency use authorization, many of the states did not recognize people with disabilities and chronic conditions as a priority population. These people were at particularly high risk of infection with or severe consequences from COVID-19. Physical communication and procedural barriers were common in both testing for COVID-19 and vaccination. And deaf, hard of hearing, deaf-blind, and blind individuals faced a profound communication gulf as face masks became commonplace, which made the lip reading impossible unless the face masks were clear, and sign language harder. Both youth and adults with mental health disabilities that predated the beginning of the pandemic experienced measurable deterioration over its course. This was made worse by a pre-existing shortage of community treatment options, effective peer support, and suicide prevention support. In short, the pandemic inflamed existing barriers for people with disabilities in healthcare.
So in a hospital, in a clinic, in other healthcare settings, what obstacles might we face as healthcare professionals when we're trying to care for patients with disabilities?
Yeah, that's a great question. Overall, the inpatient setting is a very critical area to minimize obstacles when providing care to people with disabilities because these pitfalls can contribute to acute morbidity and mortality. So the environment of a hospital offers many social interactions between patients, their families, and the interdisciplinary team. When admitting a patient to the hospital, for example, did you obtain the patient's preferred accommodation? Are you safely transporting their wheelchair or other access equipment to prevent damage? If a patient is being admitted at nighttime, do you have access to a 24/7 sign language interpreter to explain the admitting diagnosis? Once a patient is admitted to a hospital or long-term care facility, I'd encourage you to consider how the difference in living environment, even when temporary, can exacerbate a patient's disability. For example, a neurodivergent patient who requires a certain texture of bedding or mattress may have increased anxiety while using a hospital bed. Perhaps a patient is missing their weekly acupuncture appointment due to being in the hospital and their chronic pain is flaring up. Or a quadriplegic patient who is typically accustomed to being repositioned every hour is now being turned every 2 hours per hospital policy, thus increasing their risk of pressure injuries. And finally, a patient who uses special equipment to manage their disability, such as a service dog, massage gun, etc., they may not have access to this while in the hospital. Research indicates that patients form trust impressions quite quickly, and that trust does not have to do with how well a patient knows their provider. So this is particularly imperative for the inpatient setting, as many healthcare providers only spend a few minutes at a time with each patient due to rounding, charting, etc., and they don't typically have that long-term rapport with a patient like an outpatient setting may offer. Snap judgments can quickly be made on both ends of the patient experience, so overall, it's important to remember that a patient with a disability knows their body best. Now, as a provider nowadays, especially one with a disability, it's my job to trust my patient's expertise and listen to the way that the patient describes their disability, especially given that I may not have this rapport and I don't understand. Even if I have, quote unquote, the same diagnosis as my patient, we experience very different interactions with society and with our own body and our needs. It's also important that I understand the structural ableism that's exacerbating my patient's health condition, so I can offer a patient-centered solution that's actually going to be sustainable outside of the hospital. If my disabled patient, for example, does not have access to safe and reliable transportation, how can I expect them to consistently attend physical therapy upon discharge? How can I expect my blind patient to read the discharge instructions if I only provide a print version? These types of examples just show that it's imperative that I consider disability as an independent variable to the current situation, and that I communicate these access needs to the interdisciplinary team during rounds in a culturally competent way. You don't need to have an extensive knowledge of disability justice and accommodations to understand that your patients with disabilities are three-dimensional people whose access barriers can be easily dismantled by just asking what they are.
Elena, this is so important, and it reminds me of something that you shared with me earlier about snowflakes and how each snowflake is different. Would you like to share that a little bit with our listeners, what we discussed?
Absolutely, Susie. I think we had a great conversation this weekend about how access needs are really important to understand and empathize with because they're very unique. Access needs are as unique as snowflakes. Like I said earlier, two people with the same diagnosis don't have the same identity experience as a person with a disability. And so understanding that every single patient has different access needs is really essential to providing patient-centered care in any healthcare setting. And that's why I think that people with disabilities make really great healthcare providers.
That's an excellent point, and it ties in so well with our discussion about the benefits to hiring employees with disabilities. We shared a little bit of that in episode 2. To give a refresher, employees with disabilities can offer their employers a competitive advantage by strengthening employers through varied perspectives on how to confront challenges and get the job done. People with disabilities have unique lived experiences that have taught us to create innovative solutions to various barriers in a way that accommodates a wide variety of abilities and needs. There are many healthcare professionals who self-identify as having a disability, or they have a loved one with a disability, and they may have had personal experiences in the hospital. A firsthand understanding of the physical and emotional impact of an inpatient stay creates an innate understanding of patient-centered interactions. In addition to supporting existing practitioners with disabilities, we must recruit more people with disabilities to become healthcare practitioners. They could be dietetics practitioners, nurses, or physicians. But this, too, will improve healthcare for people with disabilities.
Those are really great points, Susie. Thank you for sharing. I'll give a personal anecdote to kind of emphasize this point. At my hospital, I recently received an award for my compassionate care. And at first I was surprised and of course so honored, but I realized that part of my care style is that I use my lived experience to demonstrate care that I crave during past hospital admissions as a disabled person myself. I really can't tell you how many patients I've had that express immediate relief upon seeing myself, who's a healthcare provider with a visible disability. And many have told me that it's so nice to have someone that gets it and that the resources that I provide to them make it seem more sustainable and accessible. And this is, of course, not to toot my own horn, but this is actually quite common feedback for providers with lived disability experience. Training and hiring more healthcare professionals with disabilities will both improve bedside manner and cost the hospital less in training and hiring personnel. Because as we learned in episode 2, people with disabilities tend to stay at jobs longer. People with disabilities bring their skills and talents to our nation's workforce every day. We perform all types of jobs at all levels and businesses of all sizes. We're entrepreneurs, innovators, and community leaders. But people with disabilities, including veterans and service-connected disabilities, they have lower rates of employment than the general population. This is true despite the fact that people with disabilities often exemplify qualities employers seek, including adaptability and resourcefulness. Disability is diversity, and therefore it's a key component of workplace diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. But to make this work, it's really important to mention that hospitals must facilitate an inclusive environment that makes disabled clinicians and interns feel welcome within the hospital culture. Some employers might have reservations about hiring employees with disabilities due to concerns about needed job accommodations, but these concerns are largely unfounded. In a previous episode, for example, we shared information about the Job Accommodation Network, or JAN. Research conducted by JAN reveals that the majority of workplace accommodations cost nothing to make. Of those that do cost, the typical one-time expenditure is only $500. Also, according to the employers surveyed by JAN, accommodation generally resulted in benefits to the company, such as reduced insurance and training costs, as well as increased productivity and morale.
Well, that's an excellent call to action. What recommendations would you both suggest to make this happen?
Earlier, Susie wonderfully discussed a report about the impact of COVID-19 on people with disabilities. I'll share a few of the key recommendations from this report that concerned healthcare. And it's important to note that before I do mention these recommendations, they are important not just for COVID-19, but for healthcare in general. All hospitals and managed care plans that receive federal financial assistance should be required to increase public transparency of and non-discrimination in due process within crisis standards of care guidelines and medical rationing policies adopted during public health emergencies and emergency surge situations. A patient's bill of rights for people with disabilities should be developed to address effective communication, policy modifications, treatment without discrimination, access to personal support persons, use of personal medical equipment, advanced directives, including physician orders for life-sustaining treatment or do not resuscitate orders without undue influence, information on and assistance for returning to the community from hospital or institutional care, and treatment decisions free of bias about one's quality of life and capacity to benefit from treatment due to presence of a disability. Another recommendation is that a healthcare technical assistance project should be created to inform a range of healthcare providers on civil rights issues regarding patients with disabilities. Hospitals and other healthcare entities should also be directed to include in their non-discrimination notices and staff training the recognition of policy modifications as part of a patient's right to effective communication, in addition to the provision of auxiliary aids and services when needed by patients with disabilities to receive effective care. State hospital associations should develop guidance and best practice to ensure effective communication in hospitals and associated urgent care clinics during public emergencies. And this includes the provision of qualified in-person interpretation, as I mentioned earlier, and fully accessible telemedicine programs consistent with the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines standard. And we'll talk more about that in episode 5. Concerning mental health and suicide prevention, Congress should permanently authorize telehealth flexibilities that enable telemental health services, while also ensuring that in-person services and hybrid in-person and virtual services are available options for those who may need and want them. So to summarize, COVID-19 exacted a very steep toll on certain populations of people with disabilities. And the events that unfolded during the pandemic, including measures to mitigate the spread, they posed unique problems and barriers to people with disabilities. The pandemic also exposed extreme disability bias and exposed failures in modifying policies to accommodate the needs of people with disabilities. Gaps in disability data collection and anti-discrimination laws need to be rectified before the next pandemic or public health emergency. And this is a really great report that I'd encourage you to read. And if you're interested in more, it's available on the National Council on Disabilities website.
That was great information. And given that we're especially interested in the nutritional aspects of care, what challenges do you think we might face when we're trying to carry out dietary interventions?
So for people with disabilities, nutritional barriers start everywhere in the inpatient setting, and they start as early as in the emergency department, for example. Consider how the structure of emergency departments may not be accommodating to a patient's specialized needs. A patient may be stuck in the ED for 24 hours or even days at a time, and healthcare staff in the ED are very busy, and they may not have time to provide eating and drinking assistance, toileting assistance, and other accommodations as much as the patient with a disability needs. Perhaps the patient who receives chronic G-tube feeds may not receive this until they get to the floor. Additionally, the purview of the hospital kitchen may be limited in the emergency department, so certain food options may not be available to a person with a specialized dietary requirement. And this alone can impact a patient's nutrition and hydration status even prior to getting on the floor. So some patients may be fortunate enough to have a family member or personal care attendant to accompany them in the ED, but others may need medical attention during a time that their attendants are off, or they may be coming from a long-term healthcare facility. Once a patient is on the floor, a patient's specialized needs typically become apparent through the admission and screening process, but this, of course, may take some time. Additionally, communication barriers that impact the natural flow of the nutrition screening process may prevent a patient from being seen by the dietitian in a timely manner. Nurses are typically required to conduct a nutrition screening prior to or upon a patient's admission, and this may flag a patient's specialized feeding needs, for example. If a patient with disabilities is nonverbal or does not have a support system with them, these issues may not be properly identified to trigger the dietitian consultation needed to provide access. Patients in the hospital are temporarily living there, sometimes for months at a time, so independent living needs must be considered on top of medical needs. If the patient does not have access to the equipment, assistance, or environment they're typically used at home to nourish themselves, then their nutrition status may deteriorate.
During our previous episode, we reviewed various adapted kitchen tools and utensils that help people with disabilities eat independently and with dignity. Many of these adapted kitchen tools and utensils are usually not available in the inpatient setting, but they should be, because inpatients with disabilities eat too. And these adapted tools and utensils can help inpatients with disabilities to feed themselves with independence and dignity. Additionally, barriers to how patients with disabilities read and select their meal and snack items need to be dismantled so they have the same opportunity to select their meal and snack items as people without disabilities. Overall, as Elena so expertly described, it's imperative that the admission screening process considers the accommodations needed for inpatients with disabilities when it comes to nutrition, personal care, communication needs, and more, in order to provide comprehensive, timely care for them to prevent further adverse outcomes. This, in turn, will make it so much easier to proactively provide the appropriate accommodations and specialized resources, whether it's from a registered dietitian, a speech pathologist, or one-on-one feeding assistance that's needed to prevent nutrition deterioration during the inpatient stay for people with disabilities. When these specialized services are provided, it's up to these care providers to keep in mind that disability is culture and thus provide culturally competent care to encourage patients with disabilities to increase their oral intake, accept diet education, and make informed decisions.
Thanks for that, Susie. And one note to our listeners. Susie spent some time in episode 3 reviewing adaptive kitchen tools, and it's really worth hearing. And with that in mind, what resources are available for clinicians and students and interns to support implementing some of these interventions you've discussed today?
That's a really wonderful question. Thank you. I want to reiterate the importance of seeking out resources that incorporate disability into health justice and diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives, such as Health Justice Commons, Sins Invalid, Georgetown University's Cultural Competency Training, and much more. As I discussed previously, these resources are essential to understanding how disability is a socially stigmatized experience that can actually lead to disproportionate access to equitable healthcare, nourishment, and wellness, for example. But let me mention a couple other resources that I have not yet spoken about because they're very important. These include the Institution for Patient and Family-Centered Care. This institution provides consulting, education, and hosts seminars on providing patient and family-centered care in healthcare on a general level. So that means a level that doesn't necessarily center disability. Another great resource is the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Foundations of Health Equity Self-Guided Training Plan. This is an online self-guided program designed to facilitate an individual's foundational knowledge and skill developments on topics related to health equity, health disparities, and structural and social determinants of health. And again, this resource is very important, but it doesn't necessarily center disability. But it's important to understand these general resources because disability is an identity that intersects with others. One great disability-centered resource is the Alliance for Disability in Healthcare Education. And this is a nonprofit organization that provides resources, hosts conferences, and creates competencies to increase disability-centered care in healthcare training. A final one that I'd like to mention that I really should have in the previous episode, but doesn't necessarily relate to healthcare specifically, is the Disability Visibility Project. This is an excellent resource created by Alice Wong that I think is important to mention because I've mentioned a few disability justice-focused disability resources, but this is an important one as it highlights the stories, media, and communication behind disability culture. I'd really encourage listeners to educate yourself on disability culture in order to provide care that emphasizes with disabled joy and nuance. Overall, there's a need for more healthcare diversity resources and systematic policies that incorporate disability justice and culture. Resources concerning disability as culture are especially needed concerning nutrition needs and care. And we've discussed many of the ways that we as providers can shift our perspective and provide disability-centered care. But one thing I really want to be clear about is that there are also larger structural inequities that prevent healthcare providers from delivering disability-centered care as well. Insurance, training, and hospital administration, for example, play a big part in this. Historically, the healthcare system has intentionally used barriers on both the patient and the employee side to rationalize the institution of people with disabilities in long-term care settings, for example. As providers, we can discuss providing patient-centered care and disability cultural competency until the cows come home. But until there is a reform of the healthcare systems that isolate, stigmatize, and profit off of people with disabilities, we can do the best we can as healthcare providers by educating ourselves and trying to optimize the quality of life for our disabled patients.
Well, perfectly said. And thank you both for another successful podcast episode. I think these are great ideas and hopefully easy to carry forward by our friends listening today. So thank you.
You're welcome. As you can tell, Elena and I are very eager to share about healthcare for people with disabilities.
Absolutely. We've loved sharing our thoughts, and we think they're a great starting point for providing disability-centered care.
Now, in our final episode in this series, we'll talk about something near and dear to my heart as a digital strategist, and that's how to dismantle barriers in the digital space that stand in the way of meaningful and effective user experiences, not just for all users, but especially for people with disabilities. And in the meantime, if you're looking for more podcasts, we have dozens and dozens across a variety of different nutrition science topics, and you can find them on ANHI.org by clicking resources at the top of the page, then podcasts. We are also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, so be sure to subscribe to ANHI's Power of Nutrition podcast series to hear the latest nutrition science news and share it with your colleagues. Thank you, everyone.